Ever notice how you become a slightly different person depending on who's in the room? With your parents, you're the responsible one. With your partner, maybe you're the anxious one. At work, you're the capable problem solver. But who are you when no one's watching? This question sits at the heart of one of our most universal struggles. We're so busy managing everyone else's reactions that we've lost track of ourselves. We've become emotional chameleons, shifting and adapting to keep the peace, earn approval, or avoid conflict. The exhaustion is real, and it's not a personal failing. It's a predictable pattern that plays out in families and relationships everywhere. Understanding these patterns offers something rare, a way to stop performing and start living authentically, even in our closest relationships. Think about the last time you agreed to something you didn't really want to do. Maybe you said yes to hosting Thanksgiving again, or nodded along when your friend chose a restaurant you can't stand. In that moment, you weren't being kind. You were managing anxiety. We all do this dance, prioritizing harmony over honesty, accommodation over authenticity. This is what happens when we become overly relationship-oriented, investing enormous energy into predicting and controlling others' reactions while they do the same with us. It's like a psychological arms race where everyone loses. Marie's story captures this perfectly. At 28, she worked at her mother's alma mater, hung out with her boyfriend's friends, and couldn't articulate what she actually wanted from life. She'd borrowed an entire existence. When frustration built up, she had three options: accommodate more, rebel and pick fights, or distance herself emotionally. Sound familiar? These are our go-to moves when anxiety spikes. We become what others want, we push back aggressively, or we disappear. None of these responses involve actual self-direction. They're just different flavors of reactivity. The alternative isn't abandoning relationships, but adding more you to them, defining your thinking while staying connected, which requires tolerating the discomfort of potential disapproval. When relationships feel fused, where your mood depends on someone else's mood, life becomes an emotional roller coaster. Dan couldn't tolerate his daughter Alex's discomfort with his new stepfamily, so he'd cancel plans last minute. Alex would agree to awkward family dinners to calm her dad, then grow resentful. Their predictable cycle: Dan texts his distress, Alex accommodates despite annoyance, resentment builds, Dan showers her with attention, Alex distances herself, brief calm, then Dan feels upset and it restarts. Fusion isn't dramatic fights. It's subtle accommodations that drain your energy. You make micro adjustments based on your audience, agreeing with your boss's questionable idea, laughing at unfunny jokes, pretending you're fine. These seem harmless, but cost you the chance to discover who you actually are. You never learn what you truly believe because you're managing everyone else's comfort. The path out isn't cutting people off. It's developing differentiation, staying connected while thinking for yourself, being the third way between giving in and giving up, between fusion and isolation. When one person stops doing what normally calms things down, the entire pattern shifts and new possibilities emerge. At 73, Margaret looks back on a lifetime of decisions made to please others. She married a Catholic man despite her Southern Baptist family's objections, but even that rebellion was just another form of reactivity. Now, in a retirement community during the pandemic, she faces tension between her son's safety concerns and her neighbor's social expectations. She spent decades caught between individuality and togetherness, never quite sure which voice is truly hers. Most of what you believe isn't really yours. Your brain is a buffet of borrowed ideas from family, friends, coworkers, and social media. We adopt beliefs to fit in or reject them to rebel, but both responses lack genuine self-examination. This collection of borrowed thinking is your pseudo-self, highly negotiable opinions that shift depending on who's in the room. Your brain's default mode network spends its downtime obsessing over what others think, running social calculations about past and future interactions. This mind-reading ability makes us empathetic and cooperative, but it also distracts us from knowing our own minds. The goal isn't to stop caring what others think, that's impossible, but to become more of a mind-knower rather than just a mind-reader, developing beliefs based on your own reasoning rather than borrowed certainty. After her father died, Susan quickly stepped into his role as the family's over-responsible one, managing her mother Maureen's life down to the smallest details. She also coached her brother Stephen on how to interact with their mom, mentored coworkers at the expense of her own work, and planned perfect gatherings for friends where she managed everyone's experience. Susan was everywhere, solving everyone's problems. Except she wasn't really helping. She was managing her own discomfort with watching others struggle. This over-functioning, under-functioning dynamic is seductive because it works temporarily. The over-functioner feels mature and needed. The under-functioner gets everything done for them. But it's a devil's bargain. Under-functioners become increasingly helpless, sometimes developing physical symptoms or substance issues. Over-functioners burn out, becoming hypersensitive to others' distress and unable to tolerate anyone's struggle. The real problem isn't the actions themselves, making dinner, giving advice, helping with tasks, but the anxious process behind them. Are you acting from genuine belief or just managing your own anxiety? When you're always coaching others, they stop thinking about managing themselves. The shift requires moving from being responsible for people to being responsible to them, showing curiosity about their thinking rather than assuming you know it, being honest about your beliefs rather than hiding them to keep peace, and promoting their independence rather than their dependence on you. Lewis thrived in groups, marching band, residential advising, office cheerleading. Around others, he seemed capable and motivated. Alone, he struggled with basic adult tasks like managing finances or making decisions. Living with his husband Drew had improved his bank account but stunted his growth. Drew handled everything, growing increasingly resentful while Lewis felt paralyzed, unable to step up even when he wanted to. This is underfunctioning, the flip side of Susan's overfunctioning. Lewis had learned to borrow self from groups, getting temporary boosts in functioning that made him appear more capable than he actually was. Research confirms this. People who believe they're part of a team work 50% longer and report greater interest. But borrowed confidence isn't real confidence. It's like those motivational videos that pump you up for an hour before reality crashes back in. Lewis realized he needed to shift from seeking external mat talk, enthusiastic encouragement from others, to developing internal prep talk, asking himself questions that fostered self-observation rather than validation seeking. The self-improvement industry thrives on our hunger for borrowed motivation, but consuming content becomes just another way to ease anxiety without actually changing. Stepping out of underfunctioning requires explicit communication with overfunctioners. You have to tell them to back off, sometimes repeatedly. This creates tension, but it's necessary tension,